Jacinta Hallam, it's great to have you here at Booktopia.
Thank you, Caroline. I'm very happy to be here.
And congratulations on The Science of Appearances, which is your third novel.
That's right.
What I love so much about your book, I have to say, well, there are many, many things I love about this book, but I love the way it engaged my head and my heart in equal measure. Sometimes people don't get the balance of that right. Was that something that you were striving for very deliberately, or...?
Yeah. Well, I think when I write, I have to write about an idea that appeals to me. And so the novel originally started with the idea of nature versus nurture and how much of who we are is formed by the time we're born and how much of our experiences shape us. Because I think that's a really interesting idea, and I think about it a lot in my work, actually.
As a GP.
As a GP, yeah. But you can't just carry a novel on an idea. So I had to then think about the way that I would, you know, create characters that could carry this idea for me and for the reader.
So at what point did you know that those characters would be twins?
I think fairly early on. I had the idea of the boy, Dominic, probably first. He was the first character that I thought about. But I then thought about the idea of nature and nurture. And of course, the ultimate experiment in that way is to look at the effect on twins if they live different lives. And really, you know, the ultimate example of that is identical twins. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't want to write it about two males. I really thought I wanted to write a young woman into the narrative. And so the character of Mary being very different from her brother appealed to me. And she sort of just jumped off the page, actually, to me. She came very formed right from the beginning.
I love the idea that despite the fact that they're twins in terms of their arrival in your world, one of them arrived first. So they didn't arrive as twins at all,
yes.
In fact.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting. So Dom, by nature, is, I suppose, more serious and introspective, and he's the one who's going to pursue a career in science. And Mary, I'm not surprised that you say that she jumped off the page, because she is so strong. She's such a vibrant personality, and she's sort of unself-conscious in her desire. She knows what she wants from life. And I'm quite interested in that, because these are children who come from a background with no particular advantage or education. So tell us a little bit about the setting and the circumstances of their growing up.
Mm. So they are born, well, during the Depression, actually, in the 1930s, in a small country town in central Victoria that I actually name, Kyneton. That is a real town, and actually a gorgeous town now, though I think probably in the 1930s it probably wasn't such an idyllic place. They have a fairly repressed, austere childhood from what we can gather, the reader can gather from the narrative. But the narrative really starts when the twins are 13 and their father dies very suddenly. And it is the effect of that sudden death on their lives, and also compounded by the fact that they can't really talk about it within the family. It's something that's just too shocking and too awful to be discussed. This is the thing that sort of marks them in some way and sets them out on their journey in adolescence towards adulthood. I think it was a very formative thing for them.
They have quite a tough, harsh mother as well, who sends Mary off to work for the local priest cleaning his house, and he turns out to be a really sinister figure. But what you do all the way, there are so many dualities in this book. There's a darkness and then there's the light. So whilst the priest is a terrible man to Mary and causes her to run away, Dom is lucky in that he finds an unlikely patron. So would you like to say something about where that idea came from?
Yes, well, I set the two children, because of the sort of the circumstances of their father having died and so no income for the family, the two children at various times end up working to bring money into the home. And while Mary has a pretty awful time of it, really awful time of it, Dominic ends up working at a post office because work's hard to find, and he ends up working at a post office, which is actually a long bike ride away from his home in a separate town called Romsey. And there he meets the postmistress, who is actually, yes, I think she's a wonderful character. I really, really liked her. And she, I suppose, she sort of reminds me of perhaps some of the wonderful Irish women in Colm Tóibín's novels.
I kept thinking of Colm Tóibín all the time I was reading this book. Absolutely, the spirit of this book is absolutely, to me, the spirit of generosity of Brooklyn.
Ah, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. Because when, I mean, I have an Irish Catholic background, but many, many generations ago. But when I read Colm Tóibín's work, I do feel a real sort of a simpatico. I feel like I really understand what he's getting at, really in a deep way. And that's, you know, I think that's, who knows, is that in the genes, you know?
Is isn't that genetic interesting thing? In terms of nature versus nurture, you've got it right there in your own work. But I love the fact that the spirit of him hovers over your writing, because for me as a reader, the experience of reading this book, absolutely, that's who was conjured up from your novel.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful.
So you can sort of see him as your sort of writing godfather. Before we talk any more about the book, I just want to ask you about, you know, we mentioned the fact that you're a GP, and I wanted to ask you about the balance between writing and let's use the sort of clumsy word, doctoring. I mean, you're not the first writer to be a doctor, obviously. Nick Earls, Peter Goldsworthy, not to mention Chekhov. You belong to a very honourable tradition. Do you see the two things as feeding each other in some way?
I do. I really do. I think that it's actually a wonderful marriage. Through medicine, I think you're so exposed, certainly in your work as a general practitioner, you're so exposed to people and their lives and their stories that you you can't help but find stories within that work. Now, having said that, I should always try and qualify it by saying I don't actually write a patient's story, because I don't think that would be quite ethical. But you do just hear story a lot of time in your work. And
do you hear a lot of secrets as well? I mean, you know, obviously doctors have the same kind of confidentiality as priests do. And you've written about religion in both of your previous books, so you're very aware of that kind of area ethically. I'm just wondering whether there is an element of secrecy about being a doctor that is very powerfully appealing in narrative terms.
Absolutely, because you understand that if people confide in you, that this is an incredible privilege in some ways, and you have to be incredibly respectful of that. And I think too, with narrative, what you're trying to do in some way is to uncover, within your narrative writing, you're trying to uncover secrets that the readers actually hold, you know, hold close and really respect in some way. So this is sort of a reflection going on there. But I think the other side of the coin for me is that actually having become a writer, I actually feel that that's been helpful for me as a doctor, because I am so much more aware of the patient now as the protagonist of their own story, that I think I can show more respect.
So maybe
their story.
You're listening in a different way.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're listening much more in a continuous narrative sense about where does this event fit in to your story of your life and who you are as a character in your own story. And I think with that sort of depth of listening, I think you become a better doctor. I really do.
I was going to say, you're the kind of GP. You're not only the kind of writer I like, but I think that I'd really like to come to you as a doctor.
Well, one of the downsides is I probably run over time. That's because you are very invested in people's stories, I think, because of that. So I think this is a great benefit in both ways, being a writer and a doctor. I think they really benefit each other.
We talked about the country setting, the kids coming from Kyneton, but the rest of the book, the city that they come to is Melbourne. And Melbourne is a city where Mary discovers jazz and art, and also her kind of sexual fulfillment, while Dom is discovering medicine and girls and psychoanalysis and all sorts of things. So can you just talk a little bit about why Melbourne is such a sort of melting pot of all sorts of ideas in this book, and how you do something very clever? I think, you know, there's a lot of temptation for novelists who write about Melbourne at this time to use Heidi and the sort of artistic enclave of Heidi as the sort of petri dish for all sorts of experiments in their protagonist's lives. You reference Heidi, but you don't go there.
No, don't go there. No. Well, it's a little bit of just, I think, the way your research lead, you know, the areas your research lead you. I happened to pick up a wonderful book written by a woman who it was sort of funded through the gallery, the National Gallery of Victoria, and she wrote about a studio, an artist studio in Bourke Street, called run by an artist called George Bell, and was the George Bell Circle. And although really the height of that studio was probably 10 or 15 years prior to my book, it was still running just around about the time that my book was set, in the early 50s, by the time Mary gets to Melbourne. And so I just imagined that studio and perhaps some of the people that might have been there. And the book was actually really helpful as well as sort of fleshing that out. So that's just how it happened. I didn't really consider putting her in the Heidi Circle and having to actually deal with those really well-known, famous artists. So a lot of the artists in my book are completely fabricated.
Yeah, there's a little mention of Joy Hester. There's a little mention of Sidney Nolan, but then we're back to your imagined characters. Yes. I think one thing that a lot of the would-be writers who might be listening to this would like to know is, one of the things that you manage particularly well with that research is it's so embedded in the novel that I don't notice the research. I'm not aware of it. And I hate reading novels where I can tell how much homework you've done and you're so keen to show me all the research you've done. How do you embed the knowledge in the storytelling without weighing it down? I mean, this is so hard to do.
Yeah, look, probably a bit of good editing. I think there were times where I started to actually lecture the reader a little bit about historical events, but my
editor, terrible thing, if you know, you're doing too much telling and not enough showing.
Exactly. But there were sections that, of course, I loved because I found them interesting, but they went. A couple of sections like that. But I think the rest of it is, you know, so reading the research or reading your texts for research, and then I think putting them aside. And I think probably for me it was visualizing. So visualizing the space, visualizing the pier. The sea lions were performing.
Let's talk about the pier, because I think this is probably my favourite setting in the novel, in terms of you're showing me a Melbourne that I think I've never seen before. I mean, I can imagine the sort of bars and the bohemian art studios and all of that, because I know a little bit about that from other books. But the St Kilda Pier that you describe and the sort of little kiosk there that Mary gets a job in, how much of that is real? What sort of pier culture was there in St Kilda?
Well, the pier, I mean, I live not far from there, so the pier's always been there and part of my sort of memories, or my St Kilda. I happened across an amazing book about a family who had run the kiosk on the pier, and so I read some fantastic accounts of their, and they sounded like completely larger than life characters. And some fantastic accounts of what they did. Many of the accounts, obviously, I didn't include, but they did have sea lions that performed for money. They brewed their own beer in the kiosk. They were sort of always running slightly to the edge of the law, you know, just on the outskirting the law. But they you know, they had a little boat. They were real. They found trash and treasure and used it in various ways. That there were amazing stories. They were doing research on animals out in a shed at the back of the pier for some scientific organisation. It was really, they did a lot of things that I didn't actually include. God, but fantastic. they were real
sort
characters. Of
a little bit, almost like a kind of circus sort of family. They remind me of that a little bit.
Incredibly resourceful, incredibly resourceful, and had lots of great plans and
joyous, yeah, and kind, very, yes, as well, yes, which gives a lovely tone to that part, yeah, of the book. Now, one of the things that is very clever as well about the construction of this book is that you've got Mary and you've got Dom, and they've fled Kyneton under, or they've left Kyneton under different circumstances, and they've ended up in the same city. And in a way, the tension in the book comes from whether or not they are going to find each other again in Melbourne. And really, you invest that question with the same kind of tension as if you had separated lovers. Will these lovers be reunited? Is that how you thought about it?
I think it's that idea of... at the beginning of the book, I have the prologue where they are together in the womb.
Yes, that's marvellous.
And that you know, that proximity, that intense proximity. And I think I thought about it that way. I thought about these you know, fetuses that had been so entwined. And as young children also, that idea they'd gravitate to one another, into one another's bed. Whether or not I thought of them as lovers, I think it was just this idea that that they weren't whole without that,
no,
without
they,
coming
they
together.
They love each other,
yes,
very much.
Yes, and they do love one another.
But I mean that in a traditional narrative like this, you would separate two lovers and see whether or not they were going to meet again. Mm. And here, you create the same tension, except it's a brother and a sister. And, you know, I found myself getting more and more anxious about, oh, my God, what's going to happen? And, of course, we're not going to talk about what's going to happen because we don't want to spoil it. So I was just wondering about whether you were taking any cues from the way a romantic story is told in telling the story of a brother and sister without there being any hint,
yes,
of incest.
Of that. No, exactly. I don't think I did, in fact. I don't think, because I was so entwined with their own romantic sort of, you know, journeys that I didn't really think about them that way. I really thought about it more that physical reunion, which is the way that they came into the world. That was important, that they came together physically again. Yeah. Although they are together, you know, sort of emotionally, mentally, in a way. There's a little bit of echoing of their thoughts, so that and I that's the riff on the twin thing, of course, that the twins can sort of read one another's mind. So there were sort of crossovers with their emotional journeys and some of their you know, similar thoughts, but
the
physical thing was.
Any patients who were twins? Have you actually been a doctor to twins?
No, I haven't. No, I my sister has twins, non-identical twins, but no, they're not. You know, they're brothers, so they're more like brothers in a way, though that they are obviously exactly the same age. No, I haven't. No, there are some obstetricians that specialise in twins. That would be very interesting, I think. But no, I don't. I don't work with twins particularly, no.
Well, you would never tell from this book. It's absolutely marvellous, and I just want to congratulate you again on the science of appearances. Thank you so much, Jacinta.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.